Man and the Universe, the sixth chapter of The Life Divine, which appeared in January in 1915, on the 15th day of the month, probably written about a month earlier, continuing to assemble the elements of reality that we will consider throughout the entire 1100 pages. The motto with which Sri Aurobindo begins is drawn from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, which means the white-horsed one. A horse represents divine energy, divine power, moving in life. Its whiteness indicates purity, integrity of being. So this is that Upanishad, whether it speaks of the Rishi who composed it. Let's read the citation that Sri Aurobindo has selected. The first time he's referred to the Shvetashvatara so far. The soul of man, a traveler, wanders in this cycle of Brahman, huge, a totality of lives, a totality of states, thinking itself different from the impeller of the journey. Accepted by him, it attains its goal of immortality. What Sri Aurobindo is translating as the soul is the Hansa, the swan. In other discussions on other evenings, we've talked about the significance of that swan who turns from his aerial home and, looking down into the waters of creation, does a swan dive and arrives purposely here, the swan representing the divine person, but also the true individuality in each of us. So it is not an accident that has drawn us here. It is a felicitous descent. We have come here from that home, from that empyrean of delight, and seek to find that same delight hidden in the waters of creation, of manifestation. However dark and murky they may seem to the ego, to the swan, they are full of rasa. So this soul is a traveler and wanders in the cycle of Brahman, the Brahma Chakra, which is huge, vast, a totality of lives and states, immeasurable to the eye, beyond our ken. And this soul, this traveler, this swan, adopting the themes of creation, thinks itself different from the impeller of the journey. But there's only one impeller. And when we are accepted by him, that means when we have recognized, we are blessed, accepted, brought into immortality, which is what? The recovery of that identity with the Supreme. So, another Upanishad, another citation, which rings out with its endorsement of the cosmos, says, yes. So, I think we hardly need to sum it up, because Sri Aurobindo does it masterfully in the first paragraph, encapsulating all the previous chapters. The progressive revelation of a great, a transcendent, a luminous reality with the multitudinous relativities of this world that we see and those other worlds that we do not see as means and material, condition and field. This would seem then to be the meaning of the universe, since meaning and aim it has, and is neither a purposeless illusion nor a fortuitous accident. So to Sri Aurobindo, there is a design, an implied design, and a goal embedded in the very sinews of the cosmos. He refuses to regard it as a purposeless illusion, which would be the Advaita Vedantic perspective of things. And he refuses to regard it as a fortuitous accident either, which is the view of certain other schools of Western philosophy and also of Eastern philosophy. Back to his language. For the same reasoning which leads us to conclude that world existence is not a deceptive trick of mind, justifies equally the certainty that it is no blindly and helplessly self-existent mass of separate phenomenal existences, clinging together and struggling together as best they can in their orbit through eternity. No tremendous self-creation and self-impulsion of an ignorant force without any secret intelligence within, aware of its starting point and its goal, and guiding its process and its motion. If we just glance back at that, we see a reference with the self-existent mass of separate phenomenal existences to the skandhas of early Buddhist thought. The idea of an ignorant force traceable in times near to Sri Aurobindo, to Schopenhauer, again strongly influenced by Buddhism and by some Upanishads, who thought the world to be an expression of a kind of blind will, and the nature of intelligence arising out of it would naturally seek its liberation from it. Now, remember the context in which Sri Aurobindo is writing in Pondicherry is in the presence of both Paul and Mira Richard, who are sponsoring the publication of the Arya. Paul Richard has this view that the world is an expression merely of the will. Sri Aurobindo is insisting behind the scenes that no, it is a manifestation of delight. So there is this constant dialogue going on, which you see appearing in the pages here. Sri Aurobindo will not be quietened on the issue. He will not defer to the idea that the world is a blind chance creation. No, he insists that it is purposive and that it is harmonic in its intent, that the problems of existence, as he stated in the first chapter, are all problems of harmony. If we balance things, if our context is large enough, if our consciousness is broad, then all oppositions are reconcilable. Let's continue. An existence wholly self-aware, and therefore entirely master of itself, possesses the phenomenal being in which it is involved, realizes itself in form, unfolds itself in the individual. So the very ground of the world is this consciousness. Now, beyond that consciousness, we may peer into what seems to be a non-existence, an asat, but it is the unknowable, because even as it posits true and positive existence, it retains its freedom from it. This existence, as it posits the universe, is wholly self-aware. It is chit. It is sheer consciousness. And what else is there to be aware of? It is the only reality. And therefore, entirely master of itself, possesses the phenomenal being in which it is involved, so embraces phenomenality, assumes those forms, realizes itself in form, and unfolds itself in the individual. And in the last chapter, he described how it moves from the moorings of the universe, from unconsciousness, subconsciousness, through the conscience of the ego, and then beyond, seeking its full affirmation in the superconscient. So, let's move to the second paragraph. That luminous emergence is the dawn which the Aryan forefathers worshipped. Its fulfilled perfection is that highest step of the world-pervading Vishnu, which they beheld as if an eye of vision extended in the purest heavens of the mind. Do you remember the citations which opened the life divine? He refers here to the dawn. That she follows to the goal of those that are passing on beyond. She is the first in the eternal succession of the dawns that are coming. So that's the very first citation. And the second one, threefold are those supreme births of this divine force that is in the world. This is the reference to the three steps of Vishnu. So he's gone back to the very beginning, recalled us to the start of this, the human aspiration. What is it that we're seeking to do? But to fulfill the universe. That mysterious existence has deposited itself here, in the very earth. We are expressing earth's ascent back to that. So the full significance of the dawn is not the sun coming up in the morning. It's the dawn of consciousness. To continue, for it exists already as an all-revealing and all-guiding truth of things, which watches over the world and attracts mortal man, first without the knowledge of his conscious mind, by the general march of nature, but at last, consciously by a progressive awakening and self-enlargement to his divine ascension. So, he brings in again the notion of an overarching truth which is yet imminent. He has described here a panentheistic view, which is that the world exists within the being of this unnameable divine. And as it, in a way, floats in that being, there is no second. There is a manifestation, but it's a manifestation of reality within the context of the true and real. This truth that watches over all things is what calls the human to aspire, titled the first chapter, The Human Aspiration. So it calls him up by the general march of nature. And that is the subconscious growth But when we awake to ourselves, then we become possible. We become capable of the completion in the ascent. The human aspiration leads us back to the origin, but without abandoning the beginnings. He says, the ascent to the divine life is the human journey, the work of works, the acceptable sacrifice. He's defined it a couple of pages back in the earlier chapter, The Destiny of the Individual, in this way. The liberation of the individual soul is the keynote of the definitive divine action. It is the primary divine necessity and the pivot on which all else turns. So he says it again here in somewhat different language. The acceptable sacrifice. We need to dwell on that term because it has such a connotation in English that it is problematic for us. The term in Sanskrit is yajna, which means offering. So our offering is to redeem the world. The divine said yes to the world and invested itself in the cosmos. And what we do to redeem it is to complete this journey back. And that is the growth out of darkness through struggle, if necessary, to obtain this illumination, which unifies the whole. It is progressive. It is enlarging. It leads us to exceed ourselves. And this is the work of works. Whatever work we're doing, really, this is what we're trying to achieve. And it is to create the perfect gift, which we then offer. This alone is man's real business in the world and the justification of his existence, without which he would be only an insect crawling among other ephemeral insects on a speck of surface mud and water, which has managed to form itself amid the appalling immensities of the physical universe. This truth of things, he writes, that has to emerge out of the phenomenal world's contradictions is declared to be an infinite bliss and self-conscious existence, the same everywhere, in all things, in all times, and beyond time, and aware of itself behind all these phenomena, by whose intensest vibrations of activity, or by whose largest totality, it can never be entirely expressed or in any way limited. For it is self-existent, and does not depend for its being upon its manifestations. This is Sat Chit Ananda. Sat, existence. Chit, consciousness. Ananda, delight or bliss. This is a term that we've encountered before. He's begun to use it. It is the underpinning of all his philosophy. And he speaks about it in the next paragraph, and I think I'll save further comment until we get to it. Yes. They represent it, but do not exhaust it. Point to it, but do not reveal it. It is revealed only to itself within their forms. The conscious existence involved in the form comes, as it evolves, to know itself by intuition, by self-vision, by self-experience. So evolution reveals the self of the real. And no manifestation of it is all exhausting. it exceeds whatever it informs. It becomes itself in the world by knowing itself. It knows itself by becoming itself. So there is an inner essence which is graspable to the consciousness. And that way it comes to know what it is essentially. But it knows itself by becoming itself. And this is the process of ascent. The one, the movement of knowledge, is to recover the eternity behind the flow of time, to recover the spaceless being behind the dimensionality of the world and the person. But it knows itself in the becoming also by continuing to grow. excuse me. I'm sorry, I'm not sure which person it is on Zoom who is creating some external noise, but could you find the source and silence it? Thank you.
Can you unmute your speakers?
No, I think they've done. Good. So, I found where we were. So, just to recap, there's an inner essence, and there's a formal development in time of that essence as it shapes better and better figurations of itself. Thus possessed of itself inwardly, it imparts also to its forms and modes the conscious delight of Satchit-Ananda. So you can see the kind of growth from the partial ignorant form to the growth through consciousness to what exceeds and recaptures the essence of Satchit-Ananda in that form. So, this becoming of the infinite bliss, existence, consciousness in mind and life and body, for independent of them it exists eternally, is the transfiguration intended and the utility of individual existence. Through the individual, it manifests in relation, even as of itself, it exists in identity. Without the utility of the individual, the cosmos cannot attain its implied goal. This deeper design of the universe articulates itself in the growth of our aspiration and fulfillment. This is fascinating. It is the transfiguration intended and the utility of individual existence. Through the individual, it manifests in relation, even as of itself, it exists in identity. So it is the relational context of the universe which is a clue to our eventual fulfillment and siddhi. We find our essence in that which is timeless. We recover that sense of our identity, but we express it in solidarity with the all, with each. We find that same essence in the other. We live in greater and greater harmony, and as we do that, the luster that then escapes us and radiates out works to unify the whole. So that's a passage, one of those key passages that you want to mark in your volumes. And let's continue to the next paragraph. The unknowable, knowing itself as Satchit Ananda, is the one supreme affirmation of Vedanta. It contains all the others, or on it they depend. So I think I will say a word here about Satchit Ananda, the one supreme affirmation of Vedanta. We know Vedanta means end of the Veda, and it refers directly to the Upanishads. And then after the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutras, Bhagavad Gita, and the works of Shankara, etc. And it continues on, that lineage moves on through the centuries. But this idea, this term of Satchit Ananda, does not occur that early. It occurs actually quite late in the Vedantic stream. I think Paul Doyson noted that he couldn't find an earlier record of it than the Nrisimha Tapaniya Upanishad, which is rather late, affixed to the Atharva Veda. So if we're looking for terms, Satchit Ananda combined in one tight phrase as far back as the Upanishads, we will look fruitlessly. It's a relatively recent usage, but it does encapsulate the reality that we speak about. There is a phrase close to it in the Taittiriya Upanishad, which speaks of the Anantam, the infinite, which is conscious and which is real. Ironic that if my memory is correct, and it's in the Taittiriya, because that is the Upanishad of bliss. So Ananda, of course, is the theme of the entire Upanishad. So some synthetic mind, some soul had the experience and the realization to encapsulate this reality as Satchit Ananda. All these three at once, a triunity of being. Existence is bliss. Bliss is conscious. And bless his heart, Roberto Assagioli, the Italian psychiatrist, summed it up, because he was a great student of Indian philosophy, by saying, when you are conscious of who you really are, you're delighted. So, on this is the one veritable experience that remains when all appearances have been accounted for negatively by the elimination of their shapes and coverings, or positively by the reduction of their names and forms to the constant truth that they contain. Basically, finding that reality behind all forms, not captured in the form, but informing the form, the essence of it, the real substance. For fulfillment of life, or for transcendence of life, and whether purity, calm, and freedom in the spirit be our aim, or puissance, joy, and perfection, Satchit Ananda is the unknown, omnipresent, indispensable term for which the human consciousness, whether in knowledge and sentiment or in sensation and action, is eternally seeking. We cannot be satisfied. We will be forever restless until we get to that, when that is the warp and the woof of our experience. Puissance, by the way, is the French term for power. So we continue then. And this is another one of Sri Aurobindo's Mahavakya's great sayings. The universe and the individual are the two essential appearances into which the unknowable descends, and through which it has to be approached, for other intermediate collectivities are born only of their interaction. The various worlds. The collectivities in our community lives, whether it's a village or a group, or a nation, or a globe, it is the interface of the individual and the universe which creates it. This descent of the supreme reality is in its nature a self-concealing, and in the descent there are successive levels, in the concealing successive veils. So he's describing here what in Savitri he calls the world stair. That will come later. But there are stepped phases of the involution in which this supreme positive existence, consciousness, bliss, secures itself. And the different stadia become to us experienceable in the worlds that we can know and touch and taste and feel and see and think about, mind and life and matter. This is then discoverable to the human soul. Necessarily, he writes, the revelation takes the form of an ascent. So if the first was a self-concealing of this great reality, the revelation takes the form of an ascent. It reveals itself to us as we climb. We only begin to see the countryside the higher up we go on the mountain, yes? And necessarily, also the ascent and the revelation are both progressive. For each successive level in the descent of the divine is to man a stage in an ascension. Each veil that hides the unknown God becomes for the God lover and God seeker an instrument of his unveiling. So every time we take a step, we discover something new and more and massive. And it's a freshening revelation. We're in a new world. This is a new existence that we have to plumb, that we have to experience in all of its wonder. So we wander around and around, just like the swan that was described earlier, who is whirling about in the Brahman chakra. But there's not just one plane we do it on. It spirals up. It is progressive in its revelation. Out of the rhythmic slumber of material nature, unconscious of the soul and the idea that maintained the ordered activities of her energy, even in her dumb and mighty material trance, the world struggles into the more quick, varied, and disordered rhythm of life, laboring on the verges of self-consciousness. Nature is unconscious of this guiding and secret wisdom that exists within her. The soul that he speaks about here, this is the divine person. The idea is the real idea. Later we'll see that this is the supramental consciousness that inheres in all things. It's not somewhere else. It is here. It is there. It is an omnipresent reality. So, he's describing here the stadia of matter, life, and mind. Let's continue. Out of life, it struggles upward into mind, in which the unit becomes awake to itself and its world, And in that awakening, the universe gains the leverage it required for its supreme work. It gains self-conscious individuality. So the universe is awakening in the unit as the mind, but that is not its finest. It moves beyond that to the supreme work where it is self-conscious of its individuality in that supreme awareness. So it is the recovery of the self, which is not mere universality, not a blank, white, immeasurable existence, but is the truth of the individual too. That transcendence is the same being, both in universe and in individual. This recalls to us, and I might be anticipating this a bit, the same truth that we saw in the Isha Upanishad, where all this is the habitation of the Lord. Individual universe moving in larger universe. So back to Sri Aurobindo's language here. But mind takes up the work to continue, not to complete it. So he's describing this ascent from matter through life and mind and beyond. Mind gets a sense of this, but is not intended to fulfill it. Cannot, in fact. It, the mind, is a laborer of acute but limited intelligence who takes the confused materials offered by life and, having improved, adapted, varied, classified according to its power, hands them over to the supreme artist of our divine manhood. And that is the supramental. That artist dwells in supermind, for supermind is superman. And the fulfillment of the human aspiration is when that divine consciousness, represented in the supramental, configures itself in the human, then transformed into the superman, not in the Nietzschean sense, but in the sense that he has grown, he has outgrown the moorings of ignorance and now lives in knowledge, but still with the body as its vehicle of expression, with the life as what empowers that body, with the mind, which does the tidy work of arrangement for it, the gathering of data from the senses. Interesting, too, that he describes the supramental being as the supreme artist, because we'll see that the supermind is the home of harmony. And if we wanted to reach back into Indian philosophy, to the Kashmir Shaivism tradition, we'd find something cognate in Abhinavagupta's aesthetic philosophy, similar to what Sri Aurobindo writes about here. Therefore, our world has yet to climb beyond mind to a higher principle, a higher status, a higher dynamism in which universe and individual become aware of and possess that which they both are, and therefore stand explained to each other in harmony with each other, unified. Unity, harmony in diversity. The disorders of life and mind cease by discerning the secret of a more perfect order than the physical. Matter below life and mind contains in itself the balance between a perfect poise of tranquility and the action of an immeasurable energy, but does not possess that which it contains. Its peace wears the dull mask of an obscure inertia, a sleep of unconsciousness, or rather, of a drugged and imprisoned consciousness. Driven by a force which is its real self, but whose sense it cannot yet seize nor share, It has not the awakened joy of its own harmonious energies. Of course, this is our daily experience. Life and mind awaken to the sense of this want in the form of a striving and seeking ignorance, that's the mind, and a troubled and baffled desire, that's life, which are the first steps towards self-knowledge and self-fulfillment. So, mind is looking for self-knowledge, and life is looking to fulfill itself, to delight itself. But where then is the kingdom of their self-fulfilling? It comes to them by the exceeding of themselves. And this is the idea of yoga, that really we yoke ourselves to a discipline to grow beyond, to leave our old formation of self, to arrive at a new, like a snake sloughing off its former skin, to move forward into a new existence. Beyond life and mind, we recover consciously in its divine truth that which the balance of material nature grossly represented, a tranquility which is neither inertia nor a sealed trance of consciousness, but the concentration of an absolute force and an absolute self-awareness, and an action of immeasurable energy which is at the same time an out-thrilling of ineffable bliss, because its every act is the expression not of a want and an ignorant straining, but of an absolute peace and self-mastery. So a peace which is not inertia, a peace which is not a sealed trance of consciousness beyond. In other words, not lying in a Thomasic swoon, engrossed in the coils of manifestation at the material base. Not that. Also not hieing away to an exalted state that frees us, gives us moksha, but denies the universe, and we rest in an eternal peace apart from manifestation. Not that either. The concentration of an absolute force and an absolute self-awareness. He doesn't name it here. That is the very description of the chit-shakti. We speak of sat-chit-ananda, but to Sri Aurobindo and to Kashmir Shaivism, chit is not empty of power, it is full of power. It is a conscious power. It can do what it sees. It can form what it wishes. It's not impotent. It's regnant. It rules. So it is an absolute force and an absolute self-awareness. This is Satchidananda in dynamic expression. And an action of immeasurable energy, which is an out-thrilling of ineffable bliss, and every act and expression of that beauty, of that peace, of that self-mastery. This is the supramental consciousness beyond the realm of mind, which is our next evolutionary goal. The soul aspires to that. Mind is not a sufficient mode of consciousness to it. It is not a sufficient mode of expression. To that, the soul can awake. The mystery disappears. The antinomies of existence are annulled when we arrive at this supramental agency. In that attainment, Sri Aurobindo writes, our ignorance realizes the light of which it was a darkened or a partial reflection. Our desires seize in the plenitude and fulfillment towards which, even in their most brute material forms, they were an obscure and fallen aspiration. So we do attain, and when we attain, knowledge is fused into oneness. And we delight in delight, not in the lower forms of pleasure and the twists of pleasure and pain, but in the essence that is behind all forms. We find the secret joy, the rasa, which is ananda. The universe and the individual are necessary to each other in their ascent. Always, indeed, they exist for each other and profit by each other. Universe is a diffusion of the divine all in infinite space and time. The individual, its concentration within limits of space and time. And this, again, there's a good reference point to the first verse of the Isha Upanishad. Universe seeks an infinite extension, the divine totality it feels itself to be but cannot entirely realize. For in extension, existence drives at a pluralistic sum of itself, which can neither be the primal nor the final unit, but only a recurring decimal without end or beginning. Therefore, it creates in itself a self-conscious concentration of the all through which it can aspire. And that's the individual. It is a miniature of the universe. The old word is microcosm. There's the macrocosm, and then there's the microcosm. And all that is in the macrocosm is there present in the microcosm. All that is there in the universe is there in you. Every plane of existence, every hidden treasure that you could ever find out there is already embedded in you. You don't have to follow the gates of the senses, which turn their view outward to find that richness. It already inheres in your own being. In the conscious individual, Prakriti turns back to perceive Purusha. World seeks after self. God, having entirely become nature, nature seeks to become progressively God. Well, interesting. Prakriti, of course, is the Sanskrit term from Sankhya, originated by Kapila. Stands for nature. Purusha is the term for the real person. And here, God having entirely become nature, nature seeks to become progressively God. We earlier saw Sri Aurobindo engage the world pantheistically, and here he engages it pantheistically. And we'll find him, as I said last time, going through all these iterations, all the possibilities, the world views which see the divine in the world and the world in the divine and their many permutations. Sri Aurobindo embraces them all, swallows them all. We'll see them, touch them, feel them, play with them as we go through the entirety of the life divine. So we're going to do at least one more paragraph. Deep breath. Stay with me. On the other hand, it is by means of the universe that the individual is impelled to realize himself. How did we begin? With a citation of the swan who comes to realize that the impeller above is the same as himself. And when he recognizes that, then the reunification of those two can occur, individual and the great person. Not only is it his foundation, his means, his field, the stuff of the divine work, but also, since the concentration of the universal life, which he is, takes place within limits and is not like the intensive unity of Brahman, free from all conception of bound in term, he must necessarily universalize and impersonalize himself in order to manifest the divine all, which is his reality. It's a wonderful statement. So it is not sufficient for us to find the secret soul behind the formulations of our personal nature. In later language in the Life Divine, he will call this the psychic being. But in finding the key to one's individuality, one has to expand beyond that and become universal, become a cosmic self, be capable of containing multitudes within, be capable of sheer impersonality, being none of them at the same time that you carry and can manifest them all. The individual must become cosmic, and both, again, individual and cosmos, are expressions of the transcendent. Transcendent, universe, individual, the three terms of existence, and all things are combinations and plays of those deep relations, the all and the one in the all, the one in each in all, the all in each. Yet is he called upon to preserve, even when he most extends himself in universality of consciousness, a mysterious transcendent something of which his sense of personality gives him an obscure and egoistic representation. Otherwise, he has missed his goal. The problem set to him has not been solved. The divine work for which he accepted birth has not been done. So until we regain that transcendence, until ultimately we go beyond existence into that which cannot be manifested, until we secure the freedom within ourselves of identity with the unknowable, our work is unfinished, and our birth has not been fulfilled. Let me read through this paragraph, this next one, and maybe we'll take it up and begin with it next time, but this language is so wonderful. I want you to go out with this singing in your ears. The universe comes to the individual as life, a dynamism, the entire secret of which he has to master, and a mass of colliding results, a whirl of potential energies out of which he has to disengage some supreme order and yet some unrealized harmony. This is, after all, the real sense of man's progress. It is not merely a restatement in slightly different terms of what physical nature has already accomplished, nor can the ideal of human life be simply the animal repeated on a higher scale of mentality. Otherwise, any system or order which assured a tolerable well-being and a moderate mental satisfaction would have stayed our advance. The animal is satisfied with a modicum of necessity. The gods are content with their splendors. But man cannot rest permanently until he reaches some highest good. He is the greatest of living beings because he is the most discontented, because he feels most the pressure of limitations. He alone, perhaps, is capable of being seized by the divine frenzy for a remote ideal. We'll come back and treat that paragraph more fully. opening next week's discussion, but have you questions or answers tonight? Good. Then we will march in procession into meditation. Namaste. Jai Ma.